Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. Coming up on this week's show, we have a fantastic interview with former Republic of Ireland international, two-time FA Cup winner and UEFA Cup winner, Tony Galvin. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. Now, my guest on this week's podcast has had a storied career in football, playing with one of the great teams of the 80s in Tottenham Hotspur, winning two FA Cups and a UEFA Cup. He played for the Republic of Ireland and playing in all of Ireland's games in Euro 88 as well. He has a book talking about his and his brother's football lives called Galvanised, the footballing tale of brothers Chris and Tony Galvin. And I'm delighted to say that Tony joins us on the podcast. Where do we begin with your fantastic career? If we go all the way back to the start, maybe where does your love of football begin?
I went to grammar school when I was younger, but we were a rugby union school actually. So we weren't allowed to play football. I mean, I'm sure it's the same as some kids in Ireland that maybe went to the wrong school. And certain sports you're allowed to play. So I was always interested in football because my brother was a professional footballer and he joined Leeds United in the 60s.
Wow.
So it's something I was interested in, but as I say, I wasn't playing a lot of football at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting you kind of talk about it that way because we've had guests on before like Owen Hand and the likes, and they kind of said the same thing. They went to a Christian Brothers school where they only expected you to play Gaelic football, and that was that. Mm-hmm. And once they were told you weren't allowed to play it, that probably made them more determined to play the game. Was it kind of like that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to play in the fields with my brother and my dad a lot. And obviously, there was minimal amount of football on television in those days. So played a few games out of school with YMCA. So you probably know they had a few kids' teams played on a Sunday, but very little. And then when we were 15-year-old, the PE teacher, who was involved in lots of different sports, decided that the school would allow us to play football. So that was towards the GCSE time. We were continuing to play rugby union as well. And we joined a local sort of Huddersfield League. And sort of from that point, I really got into it and started to enjoy it, but still enjoy playing rugby union as well. And the thing about rugby union, which taught me a lot, was it toughened you up. So therefore, you tried to avoid getting involved with referees. That was a definite no-no in rugby union. And when you were tackled or hit or hurt, you never showed it. You had to get up and carry on, don't show any weakness. And I think that I carried that on definitely into my football. Never show weakness. If you get tackled, get up. Don't show your hurt. I mean, it's a bit different to that these days. Obviously, I appreciate it, but that's the way we were brought up. And I think it did help me not biting, sort of biding my time to get my own back, if you like. That's what the clever way to do it.
No, I was just going to ask, is in 70s and 80s football, you kind of needed to be tough, though, didn't you? Because like we've kind of discussed on the podcast before about, you know, how hard it was for referees to actually send you off. You needed like to assault a player to send somebody off.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, that's very true. When I joined, but was playing non-league football when I was at university, and it was called the Northern Premier League. So we had teams like Wigan and Scarborough and Altrincham. Some of the teams obviously went into the Football League, and my goodness, they were tough. In those days, you had a lot of ex-pros going into non-league because they didn't earn a lot of money. So when they get to sort of early 30s, they went and played for teams like Wigan and Altrincham, having had reasonable careers maybe in third and fourth division. My goodness, some of those boys were tough. They were men, and the referees absolutely gave you nothing as an attacking player. Basically, they used to kick shit out of you. And then they used to look at you when you were lying on the floor and say, go on then, you want to play football? You want to play a man's game? You know, there was no respect at all for a young lad coming into, you know, maybe making a career, either in non-league or going on to football league. It was like, come on, are you man enough? Can you cope with it? And the verbals, well, it was unbelievable. And the referees just stood by at that level and just accepted it because they knew all the senior players, you see. They knew they were and they respected them, the referees. And you were a nobody coming into them, their league. So they always sided with the experienced professional. So you just had to get up and get on with it and never show weakness. But I'd certainly had a lot of kicking in that league. So therefore, when I did join Tottenham, I was certainly tough enough. Being tough wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
And you are quite right about the referees. I thought once you went into the football league, you know, when you play for a club like Tottenham, that the referees would give the benefit of the doubt to the attacker. Oh, no, how wrong was I? No way. It was unbelievable. The referees, you know, top all-backs like, you know, Viv Anderson would be a good example. You get... The ball would come over in the air and Viv would just come across you and smash you across your face and say, oh, sorry, didn't mean that. And the referee would have a word with him. And the same thing would happen again. Then he'd bring you down. So probably after the third tackle, the referee might talk to him. By that time, we're half an hour into the first half. You know, you're bruised and battered. And then it had to be really serious for a man to get sent off. Yeah. Really serious. Normally, you know... A punch or maybe pulling somebody backwards for own goal. Mm. But it was like that. It really was. I mean, it would be lovely to play now where the benefit of the doubt always seems to go in the favour of the attacker.
Absolutely, yeah. You mentioned your brother was a professional footballer as well. Is there a lot of football in your family, your dad, your granddad, etc.?
Yeah, no, my dad was just a local amateur footballer. He always played football and football in the winter, cricket in the summer. Obviously, we're from Yorkshire. Cricket was obviously featured in our lives as well. But yeah, my dad was just a sportsman. But my brother was always wanted to be a professional footballer. And so, you know, he had a career in football. So it was obviously part of our life. But sport was part of our family. Sport was very important. As I say, football in the winter, cricket in the summer. I mean, that's long gone, isn't it? You know, cricket all year round, football all the year round.
All you needed was rugby league to complete the set for a Northern lad.
Did you?
Am I right in saying that your granddad is from Limerick? Is that true?
My granddad was from Limerick, which was one of the issues when I was qualifying to play for the Republic because it took him quite a long time. They seemed to, I don't know what happened. It seemed to take an awful lot of time to find proof of where he was born. It seemed to be pretty straightforward from our end, but they wouldn't call them slow. They took the time to find the evidence. I would have thought that the job could have been done in 12 months quicker. But it did seem to take a long time. Mm. Because I used to ask Chris Newton when he used to come back, I said, have you any news? Have they found the birth certificate yet? And, oh, yeah, they're on it. Yeah, well, we know that.
Get on it faster. You're growing up, was there a point where you kind of realised that you had a talent for football and there is a possibility somewhere of being a professional footballer?
Yeah, that's a really good question because no. The answer is no. Never really thought about it. As I said, when I was at university and trained to be a teacher, the non-league thing was really helpful because, you know, we began £20 a week. 15, £20 a week in those days. And that was really important because the grant never seemed to be enough. We used to get a grant and I never got the full grant. So it was really important. And I just enjoyed playing football. But never at any time did I think, oh, I could make a career out of this. Until the manager of Gold Town, Alan Turner, mentioned that one or two football league clubs had been watching me. And then a few bits appeared in the paper. It was...
Was that a big surprise to you? Because by the sounds of it, you were just kind of getting your head down, doing your best for the for your team, yeah. And that was basically it. And you didn't realize that there was people watching you.
I didn't realize. No, didn't have a clue. But then what happened? You know about these things. There's a bit of a snowball effect. What happened was that somebody mentioned something, and then you read something in the paper, and it sort of moves on and moves on, and then the street clubs and somebody else is coming to watch you. Think of teams like Scunthorpe, Grimsby, Hull. Because I was playing for Gull Town, which is near Hull. So these were the sort of teams, local teams. And then completely out of the blue, Alan mentioned that Tottenham have shown some interest. That was a Tottenham area scout who I never met. And that sort of came out of the blue, that one, because all the other clubs were sort of northern, northeastern clubs. Mm. So, that was a bit of a shock.
So you're playing for Gull. How does that kind of happen that you end up going from Gull to one of the most famous names in English football?
Yeah, I mean, the Tottenham thing sort of came out of nowhere, and the next thing I know was that Alan told me that we were playing place called Buxton, which was in the Peak District.
That's right, yeah.
A midweek game, the weather was absolutely appalling. And he said, I think somebody from Tottenham is coming to watch you. So obviously, it sort of pre-warned me and it makes you a little bit nervous. And then that was the last I heard of that. I mean, the game was absolutely appalling. It was played in snow, wind, and it was just unbelievable that anybody would make that effort to travel all that way in absolutely appalling weather conditions. I think it was a draw. It was either 0-0 or 1-1. It was an awful game. There'd be a couple of hundred people there. And I thought after the game, there's no way anybody's going to get through that weather from London. Because I was told somebody from the club, actual club, was coming. And... it was only later I found out that actually somebody from the club did come, and it was Bill Nicholson,
wow,
who turned up with his wife. And apparently only stayed for half of the game. So that message came back to me, and I thought, oh dear, that doesn't sound good. And then within a couple of weeks, they decided to make an offer. I mean, it all happened sort of within a space of 2 or 3 weeks.
And just for people who don't know, Bill Nicholson was a former Spurs manager, wasn't he?
Yeah, Bill Nicholson was like royalty, if you like, at Tottenham Hotspur, because he was the first man to win the double in English football. They call him Sir Bill at Tottenham. He's highly, highly respected. And what happened was that when he retired as a manager, as a very successful Tottenham manager, he went to work for West Ham for a while, but then Keith Birkinshaw brought him back as a chief scout because Keith thought we had too much quality, knew too much about football, we need to get him back in the fold. And he just had him as his chief scout, essentially. I know those positions don't mean anything these days, but...
Yeah.
Or something. But he would do all the watching of players. And Keith said to me when I first met him in his office that I've never seen you play. I don't know what you like. But Bill says he went to watch you for 45 minutes and he thinks you've got a chance. That's typical Keith. He didn't fill me with confidence. He just said, if Bill's watched you and he recommends you, we're going to pay 5,000. We're going to pay another 5,000 when you play some games in the first team, and that was the end of it. You're on £50 a week. Basically, get out of the office. Off you go. Go back. So I had to go back on the train to Nottingham.
Wow. So Bill Nicholson comes to see you for 40 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And gives the nod to Spurs to say, get this guy.
Yeah, came with his wife. Well, Bill was like that. He's taken his wife lots of places, lots of games. And he probably, a good job he took her, because maybe he thought, if he was on his own, he might have turned around. it was all very weird, you know. I just remember the evening. I just thought that says so much about Bill.
Mm.
That if he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. And he did it. And he, you know, thought he'd best go home after maybe 45 minutes because otherwise he might not get out of the area safely.
Mm.
The day I went down to sign with Tottenham, this is typical of football. I don't know if it's like that. It was in those days. Nottingham Forest, because I was trained to be a teacher and I was in the Trent Polytechnic. I think it's Trent University now in Nottingham. And the day I was leaving, there was a note in my old residence, which was left. I don't know how it got there, but it was a note saying, when it was written on a piece of paper, and it was saying that Notts Forest want to speak to you before you go down on that train to London. So I'm thinking that means they must have been watching me. And the only reason why they've contacted me is because they found out I'm going. I don't even know how they knew I was going to London. And they said, ring this number. And it was a bloke called Ronnie Fenton, who used to be like a chief scout for Brian Clough. So this is 1978, January. So it was, I thought, well, why on earth have they left it? So that is just so typical. But obviously I've made in my mind up that I was going, it sort of threw me a little bit, but I literally only had about half an hour to make a decision. I couldn't talk to anybody. So I had to make a decision. What do I do? So I sort of ignored it. Did nothing.
So London buses, you're waiting for a big break and two come along at the same time.
Yeah, that's incredible. And so I'm told, I don't know if this is true. I really don't know if this is true, but I'm told that a few days after I actually signed for Tottenham, that Brian Clough turned up at the Gould game. So I'm told this is true. Never been able to, you know, verify it. He turned up to watch Bill playing a game, and then somebody told him, no, Tony Alvin, he's left. He doesn't play her anymore. He's signed for Tottenham. So Brian Clough, apparently, was going to the game, turned around and went home.
Wow.
Never went into the ground. So I'm told that's true. I can't verify it. I'm told that he did turn up to a game to watch me, and he didn't realise I'd already signed for Tottenham. So who knows? You know, it's just weird. It's funny, stuck with me.
Yeah, you hear those kind of stories from other players too, that kind of those weird kind of sliding doors moments of their careers where it could have been so different.
It could have been totally different. Who knows?
Yeah, but so when you get to Tottenham, are you straight into the first team or is it you're in the youth section?
To be fair, this was January and Keith said because we're not sure whether or not you're going to make it, that's typical Keith. You can play part-time. So basically, just turn up for reserve games and you can do a bit of training when you're not doing your course. So I think that just amounted to a couple of weeks at Easter. And then, I used to just come down on a train, say on a Wednesday afternoon, and play in the reserves on a Wednesday night or a Tuesday night. Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday afternoon, I'd stay in a hotel and I'd get up at sort of half past seven the next morning and go back to college. That's how it was. It was like that for about 3 or 4 months. And then in the summer, I'd join full time. Played, I think, one game that next season, the first team. It was really struggling to get into the team, but that's where we had a very strong reserve team at Tottenham. A lot of young lads have come through the system, Chris being one of them, Chris Hughton.
Yeah.
So we had a very good reserve team. The problem with Tottenham in those days is when they just got promoted was that the manager couldn't find the right formula. He's trying players in, coming in, going out. People like Jerry Armstrong, Chris Jones were in and out of the team. And it was taking Keith quite a while to sort of finalise what was his best team. And then sort of suddenly he started to blood some of the players out of the reserves. Paul Miller started playing. Chris Hughton started playing and then sort of I followed. But by this time, obviously, I'm quite old. You know, I'm 22, 23. So, you know, I'm old. So, you know, when I became start playing, I'd be about 23 year old. A lot of people would say that's too late, but it's just the way it was. I couldn't help what happened.
Hmm. So where does the I suppose the quote unquote big break come from? Where do you remember when you started a game or when you came on for a game?
Well, I remember the first ever game that I played was when the team was struggling. We played Man City at home and we got hammered. I think we lost 3-0. But in those days, Man City had a lot of older players, but they were very strong. Yeah, Colin Bell played, Asa Hartford, Peter Barnes on the left. Peter Barnes absolutely destroyed us, you know. And I thought, my goodness, this is hard. So I was playing on the right then, and I played in that game, and I really... So, Keith came to me after the game and said, oh, well, you know, you've made your debut. That's good. But back to the reserves next week. So I had to have a few months then back in the reserves before I get my next chance. And then when I did get back in the team, they started playing me up front because he was trying everybody. I played up front for a few games, scored a couple of goals.
How do you kind of manage that, I suppose, maybe mentally, because you've had your kind of your debut. It didn't go so well. You're told right back down to the reserves.
Yeah, back you go.
How do you keep yourself going in that time?
That's tough. That bit was tough. Well, basically you're thinking, oh well, that's all right. I'm at Tottenham. I'll go back in reserves. Have a few good games. You know, I'll probably somebody come and sign, and I can go and play somewhere else. Because I thought, well, if I'm not going to make it at Tottenham, I can certainly, you know, make a career somewhere else. Maybe a division lower or whatever. So that's what I was thinking. But then the chance came up again, got back in the team. And then he was looking, Keith was sort of looking for somebody to play on the left-hand side because nobody wanted to play there. And I'd signed as a right-sided player. And for some reason, they tried me in that position in a few games. And then... I didn't really look back because nobody at Tottenham wanted to play on the left-hand side. They hated it. Ricky Miller there, and he was like, he'd start from the left side and he'd finish up on the right centre. He'd be anywhere but where he should have been because he hated it. He wanted to be in the middle, Ricky. Mickey Hazard, when he was younger, he played there sometimes, but they didn't want to play there. They wanted to be in the middle. Whereas I was quite happy to be out. I just wanted to be on the field. And that wasn't a problem for me playing on the left.
Mm. Talk to us a little bit about your style of play. I mean, how would you describe yourself as a player?
that's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that much that question, but I have been asked it. So I would probably say not particularly pretty, a bit on the rugged side. Not massively skillful, although the fact I could kick with both feet was very helpful. So I could always come back on the other foot. Direct, rugged, hard to play against physically, I would say. Pretty good crosser of the ball with right or left foot. But, you know, I could sort of get my left foot round it and knock it past a defender. Rugged, direct, two-footed, good crosser of the ball with my left or right foot.
Did you that being able to play with your left or right foot, was that something that you taught yourself, or was that a natural thing?
Some of my dad actually taught us, because my brother could do both feet. My dad always said to us both that if you want to play football and do quite well in whichever team you're playing, kick with both feet. So my dad, that was down to my dad, you know, playing in the field. We had to kick with both feet. So it was just something I grew up with, and it became natural. Mm. It wasn't never a problem.
Yeah.
I think something that's something that people don't really pay a lot of attention to these days, because there have been some outstanding players who can be one-footed. You know, we can think of who they are. I mean, Lionel Messi, Maradona, you know, they're just absolutely outstanding. They need a right foot. But for a slightly lesser player, or a much lesser player, having two feet is a real bonus. It really does. It means you can play in different positions.
Yeah.
And it also means that when defenders are lining up against you, they're never quite sure which way you're going to go. And that's important as well, because, well, he can come in on his right foot, but also he can go out on his left foot. So it's a useful thing to have.
Absolutely, yeah, fantastic. So you've kind of fought your way back into, I suppose, the good graces of Mr. Birkinshaw.
Yeah. That's right.
Was there a point where you kind of realised that this was regular team football? Now you're in the first team.
Yeah, I think I broke into the team the end of the previous season, but so when we went on the I knew I was going to get when I was getting. I got an injury, then I was a few months out. But that's just one of those things. Again, little setbacks. You have to get on with it. But I knew that if I was fully fit, that I would be able to play on that left hand side, because A, nobody else wanted to play there, and I think it was a position made for me because we also needed in that team somebody who could, let's try and simplify it. Somebody who could run about. Somebody who could run one way and the other way. Ricky was a perfect example. He could run really quickly going forward. But it's funny when he turned around and ran back towards his own goal, it's in second forever. People used to say to him, why do you run quickly so quickly running forward? You don't seem to be able to run as quickly going back. It's still the same bit of grass. And it was just a mental thing with some people. But I was quite happy to track back, protect Chris, cover for Chris. Chris liked it because Chris liked bombing forward. So I would let him go past me. Interestingly, Chris was I'd been saying to people, the first inverted fullback in English football. But people don't seem to take much notice of me. But Chris never used to overlap on the outside. He would never run outside you, very rarely, because you like covering him on his right foot.
Mm.
So Chris would be what you'd call an inverted fullback.
Wow.
Because he would go that sort of inside midfield channel. He would be running up like a wing back and be running inside you. And he loved to go in, on his right foot and play 1-2s, etc. Anyway, that's an aside, but I'm sure I'm right. I'm going to stick by that. First inverted fullback in England, in English football. I don't know about for the Republic. I don't know who played left back before him for the Republic. I don't know who it was, but he was an outstanding player.
Talk to us a little bit. You mentioned him earlier, obviously, but Keith Birkinshaw as manager. Talk to us a little bit about him as a manager in the years, the seasons to come, how he was going to get the best out of you.
Yeah, I mean, I like Keith because he was straight talking, as I've mentioned previously in this interview, that, he would tell you as he is. Another Yorkshireman, Bill was the Yorkshireman, Keith was the Yorkshireman, I was the Yorkshireman, so, it was straightforward. We all used to get on with each other okay. Very honest man, players liked him, respected him. He recently had his 90th birthday, and a lot of us turned up for his 90th birthday. He looked very well. So, there was Glenn Garr, Steve Perryman, a lot. Oh, Christian was there, Paul Miller. We all turned up for his. We had a lot of respect for him. He was just fair and honest. But what Keith did want, he wanted us to play a certain way. He wanted to play as a, attacking, progressive football. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we would probably overdo it. Well, not particularly me, but Glenn, Ozzy, sometimes they needed a ball of Pete to play in the game. But it was good to watch. And Keith wanted football to be played in an attacking way, because Bill Nicholson believed in that. That the most important people in a football club are the people who are watching, the people on the sidelines, the people in the stands. Those are the most important people. And we want to entertain them. We don't want to send them to sleep. So that was a lot of respect for Keith. Very good manager. And he had a very difficult situation at Tottenham. You know, there was always things going on in the boardroom behind him, which in the end led to his resignation, which was incredibly sad. Should have stayed at Tottenham two or three more years.
Yeah. And I suspect when he left, that's when things began to kind of team-wise maybe drift, and you kind of drifted as a team after that.
Yeah, we sort of... first season after Keith left, yeah, the players were very disappointed that he left. But we did really well. We had a really good run in the league. We had a very good team. And I just wish Keith had been there to... Peter Shreve, his assistant, took over. But I just wish Keith would have stayed. I think we were good for another couple of years, definitely, if Keith had stayed. We did really well in the league. And then we were qualifying for Europe. But sort of by sort of about 86, we were starting to... You know, the players were getting a bit unhappy. Results weren't so good. And the team started to break up. And then Peter lost his job. And then David Pleat came in and wanted to rebuild a new team. But we still had a lot of good players. There was still a lot of good players. Glenn was still there. Ozzy was still there.
Yeah.
Steve Perrin had left by then. I was still there. Chris Hume was still there. So, but I just think it... Keith leaving was that's so typical of Tottenham, isn't it? They seem to be within the grasp of success and something going to happen, and then it sort of filters out, and then they sort of, it's like a reset. Oh, here we go again.
We can do it all so, again.
We start from scratch. Yeah.
I want to talk to you about that period that you mentioned as well, around about 80 to 85. That's the Spurs kind of golden 80s at the time.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about, I suppose, that period. And first of all, I suppose winning the FA Cup in 1981 must have been huge for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. The club was had a few years previous. Obviously, they got relegated. So when Keith signed Steve Archibald and Garth Crook, they were made a massive difference. All of a sudden, the team sort of looked like it was going somewhere. They had the right sort of people out on the pitch. We had a good sort of camaraderie. We had a very good striker in Steve Archibald Garth, which complemented them really well. You know, they went really well together. We played some really lovely football, and a lot of the people who were support Tottenham now, obviously they're quite old, just remember that period as being, you know, really exciting, playing in Europe. The FA Cup final replay was probably, you know, one of the most memorable Cup finals of all time. Ricky scored one of the greatest FA Cup final goals of all time. I don't really remember.
Who set him up, though, Tony? Who set him up?
It was me. It was me. Obviously, he had quite a lot to do, but I did run the. I did have to sort of win the ball out from sort of quite a deep position. I did cover a lot of ground. Yeah, it counts as an assist. It's an assist. That's the way it is. The fact he beat about 25 players after I passed it to him is irrelevant.
Take the wins. Talk to us a little bit talk to us about that FA Cup run. Those two kind of incredible games as well for that, because it was such a mammoth, I suppose, FA Cup kind of struggle between two really good teams in yourselves and Manchester City.
Yeah, Manchester City, you know, similar to ourselves, they'd sort of not done a great deal, but obviously had massive support, lots of history behind them. So the first game, it's quite a tense affair, and I think we were sort of quite edgy. There was a lot of pressure on us to deliver a trophy. I would say physically the edge of that first game, and you know, we were quite fortunate to get an own goal from a Glenn free kick. It was a very tight affair. It was very physical, and I think we out physical us a bit in the first game. Fortunately, we went into a replay. And the replay, it was a brighter evening. It was a bright, sunny sort of Thursday evening. We had more supporters in the ground than they did because of the nature of it. Was the first replay, I think, at Wembley. And then we we started playing with a bit more freedom. We got an early goal, and I think we just, it, I mean, but they did as well. They contributed to a fantastic game. I think they played with more freedom as well. I think both teams were. It was much more of a memorable game. It was more, there's more flow about it. Two teams playing attacking football, and of course, Dean McKenzie scored a fantastic volley goal, which is often forgotten, but it was that was a great FA Cup final goal as well.
And it shows in the scoreline. You won 3-2, but it's clearly two teams that kind of maybe reversed their decision from the first game to be a little bit tighter, and because you're in a cup final now, now you're going back to the way you really play. Let's play.
Yeah, I think that applied to both teams. Yeah, maybe that's just because sometimes that early goal sort of changes the game. But it was a great spectacle. And obviously they went in front in the second half of the penalty. And to this day, I think Paul Miller, was it? And I can't remember who it was, but said he never touched him. Well, I mean, a blatant penalty. There's never a more blatant penalty than never has been. But he still said he didn't touch him. So there you are. That's defenders for you. anyway, we sort of the equalising goal that Garth got was probably, you know, Garth's most important goal of all time in his career, because he, you know, we played well, but we were losing. So Garth got us out of trouble with that goal. Typical poacher's goal. And then we were on top. We were back on top again, and we just thought it was a question of time before we get a goal. But we didn't realise it was going to be a goal like that.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to us.
The goal with Rick's blood.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that goal, because it's of all the goals scored in the FA Cup and FA Cup finals, etc. It still makes, you know, top tens, top 20s, etc. kind of lists as well.
Yeah, I should hope so. Yeah,
you were on the pitch. You were watching it. From the start of that move, what do you remember from that fantastic goal?
Well, what I remember was, well, obviously bringing the ball out, so running it, covering a lot of ground, again, sort of running out of space, thinking, well, where am I going? I've got nowhere to go. And I literally turned around, looking for basically somebody. I was probably partially knackered because I'd come quite a long way. So basically looking for someone to pass the ball to. And Ricky was the sort of player who always wanted the ball anyway, wherever he was. He'd want to play with five players around him. He wasn't bothered. So anyway, Ricky was available, as he often was. And then I watched it, because I was right out on the touchline. And so I was watching it like a spectator, really. And it only felt it was all in slow motion. And I thought, well, what's he doing? He's got beat one man, and he's beating up. Why is he not sure? I'm thinking, go on, shoot. He didn't, did he? And he delayed it. And I think he completely fucked them, because they probably thought, well, he's going to shoot. But he didn't. He kept them drinking in and drinking out. And he left it to the very, very last sort of split second to slide it past Corrigan. It was a slow motion thing. You know, they say you see things in slow motion. I thought, well, why is he not shooting? That's what I was thinking. I'm sure other players were thinking the same thing. I know Garth was. Garth was in the middle, and he was shouting, I'm shooting. but he didn't. Well, he did in the end, but there you are. It was an incredible moment. And people who were there obviously said they'll never forget it. It's a moment that stands out in the supporting life. They'll never forget
it. Absolutely, yeah. It was a fantastic goal, one of the all-time great goals, and you were a part of that as well. I have to give a big, I can't remember who the person was, but one of your defenders, one of the top defenders, made a fantastic tackle, stopped the ball dead. He was able to get it and pass it to you, and that's kind of where it started.
That'd be Graham Roberts.
Yeah.
Challenged by Graham. Gave the ball to me. You're right. Yeah, well remembered. Quite impressed with that. Yeah, yeah, that's right. It was a good block of tackle. Yeah, strong one, Graham. Yeah, Graham was playing well at the time. So that's a very good point.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, you kicked it into space, ran it on, and then tucked it into Bobby or Ricky in the end.
Ricky,
It's a fantastic moment as well for yourself as well. You would do it again the next year, incredibly. But I suppose,
yeah,
for that first time, what's it like?
Oh yeah,
going up those steps, because you often hear the folklore of it's the steps going up to collect the trophy. That's where it begins to kind of settle into you.
Yeah, I think two real things. Obviously, I remember what obviously we talked about the goal, but obviously the first time walking up the incline coming into the Wembley Stadium for the first game on the Saturday was something that really made me. It's incredible, because literally you don't realise the noise. The noise is absolutely incredible, because you walk up an incline, you can't hear anything. You think there's nobody in the ground, and then you hit that, and then they say about your hairs on the back of your head. But that was a moment that will stay with me forever. And the first time you do that, that's a special moment. And obviously the other thing is walking up the steps after you've won the cup, you've actually done the job. Walking up the steps, seeing the cup is with everybody slapping you on the back and wanting to shake your hand, that's a very special moment. Mm. Obviously I was near the back, so there was quite a few people who got to the FA Cup before me. Mm. And then you get to touch it. So yeah, they are incredibly special moments. And The first time you do it is a special one, obviously. Mm. The second year, we had a fantastic season. We had a very good team. That's the best Tottenham team, obviously, I ever played in. People, you know, we finished up, we haven't played too many games. Usual, you know, in England in those days, Football League forced me to play lots of games before the cup final, which is nonsense, and it doesn't apply anymore, quite rightly. The major fit, three games in a week before we had to play the QPR final, because they didn't want any games going beyond the final.
That's right.
Yeah. It's crazy looking back. It was crazy. We lost in the semi-final of the Cup Winners' Cup to Barcelona. That was a fix. The referee was obviously clearly bent. Everybody knew he was. And the final was in Barcelona. We lost to Liverpool in the League Cup after extra time. Thanks to Ronnie Whelan's equaliser. Yeah, thank you, Ronnie. So we had a fantastic team. And then by the end of the season, we were knackered, really. We'd sort of been fighting on different points. Mm-hmm. But we sort of go over the line. The first game we played well against QPR, should have won, lost to an equaliser. Sorry, there was an equaliser, late equaliser. And then in the replay, in the second half, we were struggling. QPR played well in the second half. Well, have nicked a goal. We sort of just got over the line. The defence played really well.
Did pressure play a part in it as well? Because there was obviously huge pressure on you to deliver with a trophy. Yeah. You'd gone through the season.
Yeah.
You were. That's right. If you lost the FA Cup final, there was no trophies. Yeah. So
absolutely.
So were you kind of? Did you feel that pressure going into the FA Cup final?
Yeah, absolutely. You thought, oh my God, we've got one more game. We just got to get over the line. And, you've seen it before in sport, that a team has a fantastic season, but they don't deliver something at the end of it. It feels like a massive anticlimax. And yeah, the pressure got to us. I think it got to our legs, particularly in the second half of that replay. We were just all so edgy, and we weren't playing our normal self. We weren't keeping the ball. And I think because we just wanted to get over the line. Mm. But yeah, absolutely, massive pressure. There really was. And it was a different feeling the second year. It was relief.
Yeah.
Everybody felt relief that they'd won the cup. Even walking around with the FA Cup afterwards didn't feel the same, because I think we're all sort of probably mentally and physically knackered. Mm. I remember that, all the lads feeling very similar feelings.
I hesitate to say, does it ruin the moment, but is it a completely different feeling to the ecstasy of the year before, and then the expectation changes everything?
Relief against ecstasy, I suppose, would be the words to describe them. One was relief, one was ecstasy.
I wanted to ask you as well, just on that too, playing at the old Wembley as well, back in the days when turnstiles, shall we say, were a little bit more freer in letting people in. You played 100,000 odd in both yeah. first matches, and then 90 odd in the second replay yeah. for those both FA Cup finals. It must have been extraordinary to go from, you know, maybe 20,000-30,000 people to this absolute cauldron of 100,000 people.
Yeah, obviously I've never experienced anything like that, and obviously not many players had unless they played in the cup final. Yeah, I mean, there was something really special about Wembley. Yeah, it was old and it was slightly falling apart, and which is why they rebuilt it. But it was a fantastic place for atmosphere. It was amazing how the atmosphere, the noise stayed within the stadium. And it was 100,000. You know, there was no ground in England bigger than, I don't know, about 45,000, 50,000. So it was an incredible place to play football. 100,000, that's an awful lot of people. And obviously making an awful lot of noise. And you've got 40,000 one end and 40,000 spawn the other team, something like that. So it was...
I just wanted to ask you as well, that team that you're, you know, the double winning team, etc. Can you put your finger on maybe why, even with a brilliant team that you had, double FA Cup winners, etc., that you couldn't just put it together in the league? That maybe you deserved the league yeah. title, but you just couldn't get it over the line.
Yeah. Well, we couldn't do it because we weren't consistent enough. Didn't have big squads in those days, but I mean, the teams that were winning the league were using 13 and 14 players. You know, Liverpool, Aston Villa, winning the league around then. We clearly just weren't. We weren't consistent. Sometimes our away form would let us down a little bit. Very good at home. You know, I remember talking to some of the Liverpool players, and they used to say when we used to go to Tottenham, we were expecting, you know, we very rarely got result. You know, Liverpool would get result everywhere, but Tottenham was a place to struggle because we were a hard team to play against. We had a very good home record. But once, twice away from home, we could maybe get out-muscled. It's like lack of consistency and players not delivering in the really big dick games, I suppose, when the pressure was on. It's a shame. It would have been good if we could have done it. We got very close, but, you know, at the end of it, the team that wins the league is the best team over the season. Round of that period, Liverpool were the team.
Yeah.
We did beat them, but maybe in the big games they came through and we didn't. So just lack of consistency. But we were still played some wonderful stuff, which supporters of teams around the country, you know, always say they were always a team that they enjoyed watching. And a lot of people sort of feel Tottenham, or if they don't support Tottenham, they might be their favourite second team.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Part 2 of our interview with Tony is out next week, so join us for that. His book again is Galvanised, the footballing tale of brothers Chris and Tony Galvin. More from Tony next week. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you get notified straight away when a new episode drops, plus some bonus clips as well. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage, it's our game. Bye for now.